Welcome to the Poet Delayed podcast. My name is Scott Edgar. I'm the host. And we have today a returning guest, a good friend. I've known him since law school. In fact, he was on episode number 3, Forgotten Walls. That was almost 2 years ago.
Great poem. Yeah. Enjoyed it.
Great conversation. But we have with us then today Mr. Barron, Josh Barron. And he is a writer. You've got a few books out there.
That's true. It is true. Almost said, no, Emma, you know.
Yeah, you do. I do. I mean, you
the have... quality I can't vouch for, but the presence, the quantity I can.
Yeah. And we're quantity over quality. that's how we measure our, worth, quantity over quality. Anyway, so this is great. I'm excited that we're going to be doing this. And I asked, you proposed a poem.
I did.
And so let's just jump into that. And if you'll read it, what I'd like you to do is just read the poem, if you would. And then I'm interested in as to why, what it was about the poem. And then we'll just kind of go off and pretend like no one's listening. And we're just going to have a conversation like we do when we're at lunch.
Great. All right. This is Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it?
I want to say one thing first. I love this. Clear pebbles of rain. Mm. That image is just fantastic. Anyway.
She's trying to describe something that's been described a billion times.
Yes.
And she still found a fresh way.
Yeah. That is clear pebbles of rain. I love it. All right. Well, talk to me then. So it's an amazing poem. What were your thoughts?
It's just, I mean, like most poetry, most good poetry, it's just like, it's full. It's like pregnant. It's got so much.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there something that, Did it answer a question for you when you read it?
Yeah, maybe the first line did. You do not have to be good. I've not always known that. I often forget that. I often feel like a pressure to be good, and that it's not acceptable if I'm not. And sometimes that's like, I have to be a good writer or else I can't write, or I have to be a good guitarist or else I can't play music. But it's also just like the general goodness, kind of like more fundamental stuff, like being a good parent or being a good human. It's hard, man. It's hard to be good. And sometimes I think like trying to be good is, it's like you have to aim at it indirectly. Like you can't, the goal can't be being good. It has to be something better than that. And then along the way, you become good.
Interesting. Whenever I hear talk about good nowadays, you know, the last few years I've been reading a lot of Nietzsche, and he, you know, one of his great works is Beyond Good and Evil. Mm. And he talks about that. You know, the question is, what is good? Mm-hmm. Because good can differ from where you are. I mean, different religious philosophies have a different definition of good.
Yeah.
What is a good parent? There can be different definitions. And as I've wondered that about good, I mean, I try to break it down to, okay, what is good? Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the thing that I was remembering was that, I started therapy, I think it's almost 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And I had this wonderful therapist for my first therapist. I don't know how I lucked into having a good therapist for the first one. And I don't know why, but one time she said, I want to read you kind of like my affirmations, I think is what she called them. see if any of them resonate with you. And so she read me like 5 or 6 affirmations that she uses for herself. And one of them was, what is good for you is good for the universe. And when she read that, it made me cry.
Mm.
I was really overwhelmed by it. And
do you know what it touched? What it was that triggered in you? What it was that touched you so much emotionally?
Because I think that I thought the opposite most of the time. That goodness was in self-denial. Like the walking on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting, that resonated with me. Like I thought that's what good people did. And so when she said, what's good for you is good for the universe, like I think it was kind of like a crossroads where I was deciding if I could let go of that view of goodness. And it's interesting, you know, that it uses the word good in that way. I think what I've learned is the universe or my family or my community or whatever doesn't need me broken. That's not helpful.
No, yeah.
It needs me healthy and productive and present. So it seemed kind of obviously true when she read it to me, but it also felt like I felt a lot of resistance to it. And so I had to like sit with it for a number of weeks, at least maybe months, before I was like, I think I'm going to let go of this other one and go on to this one, see how that works.
I had a similar kind of growing up. I found meaning in self-denial.
Mm.
I found that I'm going to try to put myself aside, and the language I would have used would have been, I'm going to lay my will on the altar of God.
Mm.
I remember there was a talk by Neil Maxwell, and he said, your will is the only thing that is uniquely yours. Mm. Now, it's a very LDS doctrinal foundational thing.
Mm.
And he says, everything else that you have has been given to you by God. Your will is the only uniquely thing that is it's the only thing that's uniquely yours.
Yeah.
And his point was, you need to take that will and lay it on the altar of God.
Yeah.
And I spent years and years and years trying to figure out, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. How do I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard for me. It was hard on me. Mm. Because I was denying myself. I was abandoning myself. I would not pursue things that I thought, well, that'd be fun. But then I think, oh, wait, or not just fun, but I'm interested in that. Mm. You know, like I'm interested in those things, but I would define them. Sometimes they were just self-def. You know, I would define them by myself. Like I would determine that, no, that's contrary to my... You know, that goes against...
I'm not allowed
to do those things, because that's antithetical to laying my will on the altar of God. And so that caused me a lot of problems.
Mm.
And a couple of years ago, I came to this understanding of, you know, living in alignment with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean... I don't understand that to mean just do whatever I want to do.
But being honest,
yes. I think that's the key. Like, honest with myself. Like, mm-hmm. Okay, what is good for me? Like, I don't... because I used to want rules from people.
Mm-hmm.
Give me rules that mm-hmm. I need to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was abdicating my personhood. I was mm-hmm. saying, I'll do whatever you want. I didn't want to make those decisions on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just abdicating it. And so you tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was righteousness. I thought that was how I can be a good person.
And I think I've done a lot of everything you just described. Do you, in that process, did you feel some resentment?
Towards the rule givers?
Maybe, or to the... I don't know. Like, was there any resentment that around?
I had a day. I had like 2 days of resentment. Literally 2 days of resentment. I had a night where I call it my avalanche of broken things.
Hmm.
One, it was like a night and a day, and then I had a kind of, it was gone.
Hmm.
what it was is I just one night I just had this understanding, like all these things that I either was that I gave up, that I didn't do out of obedience to what I thought to obedience or attempted obedience to what I thought was necessary for me to be doing.
Right.
And it all came down. I thought I'd missed out on this and this and this. I gave up this relationship. I gave up that relationship. I didn't get experience these things. And it hurt. Mm. I mean, I remember being in my bed just torn up, but then I had this realization that, okay, but here I am now. Mm-hmm. And you know, whatever I gave up, well, I'll just say this, that, you know, all of it was, I gave up in the name of religion, mm-hmm. but I also recognized that I needed that religion. I needed the structure that the religion gave me because I didn't have it outside of it mm-hmm. and it kept me alive. And so I had gratitude, even though I lost things, mm-hmm. it also kept me alive at the same time.
So it sounds like there's kind of like a clean break point where yeah. My question is, did you feel resentful during the will on the altar period?
No,
amazing.
Well, the reason being is, well, let me think about that actually before I answer that so quickly. No, I don't think that I did because there was a lot of cognitive dissonance going on in my head mm. that I thought that I knew that was the way to go. And there was a dopamine reward in trying to obey these things. Mm-hmm. Like what it did is it gave me goals. Mm-hmm. And if I ever fell short, well, at least I had a goal that I could climb up to, mm-hmm. you know? So that was the structure that I had mm-hmm. as instead of, like sometimes it was almost fun to fall back mm. and to lapse.
Because I wonder if you were making, it sounds like you were making a wholehearted choice in that earlier period.
100%.
And then the kind of assumptions changed and so you made a different choice.
Yeah, it was definitely a choice. Because I was scared to lose that because it created a safety, a structure for me, mm-hmm. you know?
Because I think, again, like, so you do not have to be good kind of connects to the line. You do not have to you do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. My understanding of the word repent has changed. I mean, it's really transformed in the relatively recent mm-hmm. it's still transforming. Like where in the past I really thought about repentance as being kind of walking through a desert on your knees for 100 miles. And now, and I think that's how she's using it in the poem. Well, obviously that's how she's using it in the poem, but like what I'm now I think of repent more as what you were just talking about, like alignment.
Mm-hmm.
It's like being true, being,
yeah.
you know, not being too hearted or too faced or, you know, like just being sincere and being honest. And so my sense is from reading some of Mary Oliver's other work, I think she'd be down with that idea, but I don't think she'd be down with self like flagellation.
Right.
I don't think she'd be into that.
Well, and to your point, I think is, I was not being honest with myself
mm-hmm. in the previous
period. Mm. It was completely dishonest with myself,
which is why I wonder why you didn't feel resentment,
because I had turned it off.
Mm.
I deadened that. Good way to say it. I deadened that because in fact I was terrified. Like, so, I mean, to be clear here, it was, you know, I was terrified of anything that would undermine the truthfulness of the religion that I, you know, mm-hmm. the Mormon faith. Mm-hmm. I couldn't read anything that would even hint at it. It terrified me
mm-hmm.
because that was my foundation. That was my mm-hmm. structure. That was my stability.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had really built a wall around that
mm-hmm.
and I didn't feel things like I, I didn't feel resentment. I just thought, okay, I'm going to go just be the best Mormon I can be. If mm-hmm. I try to be the best Mormon, I wasn't. I mean, I always, but that was the problem too, mm-hmm. you know, because I my standard was not a true standard. Mm-hmm. It was, I'm going to be the best Mormon I can be. Well, that doesn't make me a good person. You know, that just means I'm following, that just means I'm a good rule follower.
Right. Right. And I might've phrased it similarly, but I think that there's similar problems for me in phrasing it that way. I think what Mary Oliver is teaching me, well, let's, so if she was writing, I don't actually know that much about her religious beliefs. I don't get the impression that she's super religious, but, suppose she was super religious and was writing this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way I see the first line, you do not have to be good, is like, God isn't waiting for me to be good to love me. He's not waiting for me to meet some standard to, you know, give me what I need to thrive, you know. We were talking before we started recording about, you know, sunsets, and you don't have to earn them.
Right.
Free gifts. You don't have to accept them. You don't have to look at them. Whether it's God or the universe or, you know, I think there's a tendency in our culture to say, I'll be happy when I figure that out.
Yeah.
Once I'm perfectly honest, then I can be happy. And I think that she's saying, you do not have to be good. You don't have to wait until you've done some pilgrimage through a desert. You don't have to do that. You can do it now.
And I think it does. It comes back to like, what does good mean?
Yeah.
Because.
Well, what do you think she means in this poem?
Well, I think she means what I'm picking up from you is we have this, you know, I think she's touching on this Western definition of good.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. You know, I would probably define it as this Judeo-Christian definition of good.
Almost like the overly scrupulous.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just like you are obedient.
Mm-hmm.
You follow the rules. You pay your taxes. You don't speed. I mean, all of these.
I'm dead then.
Yeah, you're.
I'm going to hell.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll be there with you, so let's have our third episode recorded in hell. We'll broadcast from hell. That's what I think when she says, I think she's touching on that, because that's really, I think...
Right, she's answering the overly scrupulous religious person.
Right, otherwise I don't know that it would have meaning.
Right.
Her poem, her statement would not have meaning.
But I'm saying, so if she starts out with negatives, you do not.
Mm-hmm.
I think she gets to an answer. Do you feel like, what answer do you think she gives in the poem?
In the poem?
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer that she gives is, you are you.
Mm.
You are you. And, you know, this world is here. It goes on. I love this about it because, let me just scroll here. So she says these negatives. Well, the first two, you don't have to be good. You don't have to walk on your knees repenting in the desert 100 miles. And then she gives you permission. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And I love that line because it resonates with me. Mm. Like, hey, there are things that you enjoy, or there are things that I gave up that I didn't want to give up. But I did because I thought they were wrong. But I'm like, no, I can love those things.
Mm.
And I think it's easy, you know, we can take that and say, well, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. But I don't think that's what she's saying here.
I don't think so either.
I think she's saying, I mean, I think the use of the word love,
yeah,
is the key.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think she uses the word love in a self-indulgent way.
No.
I think she means love. Sincerely.
Yes.
In
I think
a giving it, way.
Yes. In in an uplifting way.
Right.
You know,
edifying.
That's the word.
I think that, I mean, something that I'm in process of understanding, I don't, as far as I can tell, have direct control over how I feel. I have indirect control. Like, there's things that I can do to make myself feel worse. Mm-hmm. There's things I can do to make myself feel better.
It's a good observation.
But I can't, I love what I love. That doesn't mean I have to do all the things that I love or, you know, act on, you know. But I feel how I feel. Like, I can't, I find it very unproductive to pretend otherwise.
I think more than unproductive, I think it's destructive.
I think it'd be destructive.
Because your whatever emotion you're using to fight off of those things is wasted emotion.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting you emotionally.
It's exhausting. Yeah. It's exhausting. Can I do a scripture quote? Is that appropriate?
Yeah,
I'm the poet delayed.
Of course it is.
One of my favorites is in section 25, which is the revelation to Emma to make the hymn book.
And the Doctrine of Covenants, mm-hmm. for those who aren't familiar.
And in verse 12 it says, for the my soul delights in the song of the heart. The song of the righteous is a prayer unto me. And Latter-day Saints love to talk about the song of the righteous as a prayer. So they say, well, so then when we sing a hymn, we're praying. And I think that's true. But I think that the previous one's even maybe more interesting, where he says the song of my soul delights in the song of the heart. So I don't totally know what all that means, but one meaning might be God is speaking, my soul, God's soul, his innermost, truest self, delights in the song of the heart. I interpret that to mean like our sincere feelings and beliefs. So he delights in that. So sometimes we think, I can't admit that I feel this way. And he's like, we can't even start working until you tell me how you really feel and you tell yourself how you really feel. So love what you love. Like, let's own all of that. Let's just examine it with curiosity. My soul delights in that. And so kind of going back to what you're talking about alignment. Yeah, I mean, like, if you're walking around saying, I don't love this, when you do, you can't examine it. You can't deal with it. You can't, you know what I mean? Like, you're just in this stuck, frozen state. Whereas if you said, I love this, but I don't know if I want to love it.
That's such a great point.
Then you can start to examine it and reflect on it. You know, it's the examined life instead of the rushy. You know, I feel like in 2024 it's very difficult to remember all the time what do I love, because there are so many advertising and social media and text messages and, you know. But to stop and be like, no, I'm going to let the soft animal of my body love what it loves. I may decide what I want to do with that, but right. I'm just going to notice it.
What I like about what you just said is, I think it was Jung, it might have been Freud, and I don't remember the exact. But basically, the concept was whatever you repress is going to come out.
It's going to come out stronger.
Stronger,
right.
And so to pretend like you don't like something,
yeah,
when you are drawn to it, maybe it's not a good thing. You know, I'll use, for example, pornography.
Yeah.
I used to always say, oh, I hate it. But you know what? I was drawn to it.
Yeah.
I was drawn to it.
There's a reason that it's so freaking effective.
Yes. But to pretend like, to say, oh, I hate it. No, that's not true.
That's unrealistic.
That's unrealistic.
Yeah.
And so
it's unproductive. It's destructive.
It's destructive because then there's hiding and there's, now I got to put on it.
Yeah.
But when I can say, no, you know what? It draws me in.
Yeah.
Now I could start looking at it.
And by the way, like, no one believes, you know what I mean? Like, it's the only person we might be fooling if we say is ourselves. Like, everyone knows. Yeah, pictures of naked ladies. I'm into that. Like, we're all into that. Maybe not every single human is into that, but most of us are into that.
Oh, that's biologically, we're geared that way.
Right.
So
I think, like, again, going back to that section 25 idea, my soul delights in the song of the heart. Like, don't freaking sing the song you think I want to hear.
Yes.
Sing your real song.
Right.
Tell me what you love. And then maybe we can educate that, and maybe we can feed the parts of ourselves that we want to be. And, you know, but like, pretending isn't going to help anyone.
Mm-mm. And I guess that was my problem, is that ultimately I was pretending. I was dishonest with myself about what I wanted.
Right.
I remember in 1999, maybe, I was going to Salt Lake Community College. I was in this philosophy and literature class. And I was reading these books, these philosophy books, and there was a fire inside of me, in my bones. It's like, whoa, this is what I want. Mm-hmm. I love this. This is it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was like burning inside of me.
Yeah.
But you know what happened? I thought that it was counter to being religious.
The person. That
yes.
You,
I thought, oh no, because I have to give up the religious. And so I turned it off.
Right. And here's the interesting part. It's possible that the only one who thought that there was that conflict was you.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Like your professors would have been like, yeah, you want to study Wittgenstein and you're religious? They'd be like, okay.
Yeah.
My dad is super smart, has a PhD in religion and social ethics. He's very conversant and pretty crazy philosophy stuff.
I've like, not met your dad yet.
He's at BYU now. You got to come meet him.
Provo?
Yeah.
Because he was at Idaho.
Yeah,
now he's all right. Provo. I want to sit down with him.
In Maple.
Ross, is that his name?
Ross Barron.
Oh, gosh. I want to go hang out with him.
So if you had just like vocalized to your professor or to your bishop or to your, like maybe all of them would be like, nah, it's cool. You can read Socrates if you want. Like nobody, you know. And so like you felt this tension and not articulating it, not praying it, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily like not bringing that out, hiding that is what no one's soul delighted in that. That is not delightful.
No. And what it turned out to be is I just had this internal anxiety.
Right. You were afraid of what you might find.
Right. I was exactly like I was afraid, oh, maybe this isn't true.
And so you kind of put that on other people, maybe. You kind of said, they don't want me to study philosophy.
I don't know that I ever did that. I was very much self-flagellating.
You do not have to be good.
Yeah, thank you. So after this. I didn't ever talk about it.
Right.
You know, and if I ever, because, you know, it was very, it terrified me, like I said earlier. Yeah. If ever I saw something that, like, put the credibility of the church, the Mormon church at issue, or anything that seemed to undermine it, I mean, it was terrifying to me because that was my safety, you know, that was my foundation. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way to go about life. I'm trying to, okay, I want what's true.
Yeah.
What's true.
Yeah.
And there's still fear and there's still, you know, anxiety and scariness about it. But the only way I'm learning now that the way to deal with those things is not to ignore them.
Yeah.
To go through this, to go through them. The only way through pain is through pain.
It's to express the hard and the yes. hard truth.
Yeah.
It's to pray the.
Did you feel prayer. When you were a kid, did you feel like if you had concerns like that you could go talk to your dad? Or your mom, or did you have people you could talk to?
My house was very, it felt intellectually rigorous. Mm. So like if you said something at the dinner table and then couldn't really defend it, like you're going to get mocked. It was going to be
mocked.
I don't know that I felt that topics were off out of bounds. Mm-hmm. But sloppy thinking was not super acceptable. I don't know that I've ever told my dad this. So I don't know. I can't imagine he would listen to it. But if he does, we can chat after.
He wouldn't want to listen to my pod. He hasn't listened to the other episodes?
He probably has. what I think I observed in my dad that I don't know that he ever articulated was that he held himself to very high, maybe even unrealistic standards, like mm-hmm. where like he, you know, like if somebody else wore a blue shirt to church, he was kind of like, what is their problem?
It needs to be white.
It needs to be white. What are they thinking? Like, you know, that's not what the brethren wear. And I never really thought that he meant God didn't love them, but I sometimes felt that if like he was late to ward council, that maybe God didn't love him. So anyway, like noticing that lately, and I've never talked to him about it. So maybe I was missing, again, that may have just been my perception.
Yeah, true.
But I had to kind of like notice that and go, you know, what are the implications there? It's just not just calling it God doesn't make it a good foundation.
just calling it God.
Right. Like if we just like put a set of rules together and say this is God, that's not helpful. It's got to be like God has to be somebody we can trust.
Yeah. I agree. And I like the idea. Like I heard this, I was at a very low point in my life a couple of years ago, and I was just looking, scrolling through YouTube, trying to find some like inspiring video. And I came across this video by Jordan Peterson where I know now that it was, his book, 12 Rules for Life. And it was the fourth rule, self-transcendence. That's, self-transcendence, I think is what it's called. But he talks in there, he says, you need to find a way to live, but he talked about meaning in your life. He says, it's not following a set of rules. And I've really, really grown into that. And we've kind of been talking about that already.
Yeah.
I was trying to follow a set of rules my whole life because I wanted to be good.
Right.
And, and again, for me, it was, okay, they've defined good for me. Now I have a target to hit. And that took all the stress out of trying to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, not another scripture passage. We're supposed to be talking about poetry. But...
Oh, no, scripture is poetry. A lot of I love Isaiah for that reason. Oh.
Quick as Isaiah aside. Isaiah has, like, saved me lately.
Oh, yeah? In what way?
And when I was growing up, Isaiah was tough for me because there's almost no story. It's all just prophesying, you know? And so I was like, yeah, but, like... Are they going to get the plates or not?
They're on your tail.
I needed some more plot.
Right.
And lately, when I've gone through difficult stuff, especially related to my kids, passages of Isaiah will come to me. And a lot of it through the Messiah, the Handel's Messiah. And man, it's so good.
Cease to do evil, learn to do well. That's my favorite Isaiah quote.
Well, to quote Nephi, though, in 2 Nephi 4, Nephi is...
And for those who aren't familiar, that's in the Book of Mormon.
In 2 Nephi 3, Nephi's dad dies. In 2 Nephi 5, he splits up the family. He leaves his brothers. I mean, you couldn't get a more dramatic... You know what I mean? Like... The Game of Thrones writers are probably like, oh, this is such good stuff, you know?
let's just throw some more sex into it.
That's right. And so Nephi starts this psalm, where he starts to kind of be really frustrated with himself. And then...
That's four, though.
In chapter four.
Yeah.
And in chapter four, he says, the turning point of the chapter, he says, nevertheless...
I know in whom I have trusted.
So he doesn't say, I know in what church I've trusted, what doctrine, what book, what, I don't know if I already said set of rules. It's got to be the person, because you can't trust rules in that way.
Right.
And in Spanish, there's two no words. There's saber, which is like to know something intellectually, and conocer, which is to know someone relationally, personally, to have experienced it. So you can conocer a place, you can conocer a person, you can conocer a subject, but it's not saber, it's like a very different type of knowledge. And I don't think he's talking about saber knowledge. Like, I think he's saying, I know him. And so in the same way that you can have a relationship with someone, we've been friends for over 15 years now, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And so we know in whom we've trusted. Obviously, I can't save or exalt you or protect you from, but you know me.
Right.
And so if Jesus is who certain religious traditions have said, then he's not trustworthy. But if we come to know him personally and relationally.
Let's pause. Talk more about that, because I think there needs to be a little, we need to flesh that out a little bit. When you say that if he is who these certain religious traditions have said he is, then he cannot be trusted. Talk about that. Why are you saying that?
Yeah, there was a talk at General Conference this last time that really hit me about, they were talking about this, I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was Elder Kieran, the new apostle. He was in his hotel and he's watching this road and a policeman has closed the road. and cars would come up to the policeman and he would send them away. And he was, and Elder Kieran was kind of keeping an eye on his like body. He couldn't hear them because he's in a closed room, but he's watching the policeman, and the policeman doesn't seem like sympathetic or, oh, I'm so sorry. He's just like shaking his head and pointing the other way and just kind of like actually seems like he's like enjoying this. He's like, I've closed this road and these, you know, right. The power of it.
Okay.
And then he said, that's not God. God isn't trying to turn you away. God, opposite. He's pursuing you. And so when religious traditions say, you know, that God is looking for ways to damn you, that's not a trustworthy person. Like
Calvin.
Poor Calvin.
Poor Calvin. I've got a book. Really got a book around here. Where is it? Oh, I can't see it. It's about Calvinism, though.
Yeah. Calvinism is rough.
It's rough. It's something that would have appealed to me, though.
Right.
Because it's
very structured.
Structured, set, right. And you can measure where you are easily. There's a graph.
Right.
It's a graph. You know?
Also, not in your control.
Right.
So you don't even have to feel any anxiety about...
It is what it is.
It just already is.
Yep. So you're just going and... Yeah.
And so, like, a God who would arbitrarily damn his children, I can't trust him. A God who, you know, you have children, I have children. I'm not looking for ways to... My kids think that I'm, like, lying around, like, trying to think of ways to punish them. I'm, like, opposite, guys.
I've got a book. It tells me all I need to know.
You guys are ruining my life sometimes by doing such dumb things that I have to intervene. I would love to... not like, you know, I try to only do it when it's something that's going to make you miserable. I try to only do it from a place of love. I'm an imperfect parent, but like, if even I as an imperfect parent can do that, don't you think God is trying to exalt us, not damn us? Like, opposite.
Well, I think it also depends on the religious the doctrine
of, yes,
because I mean, Mormon doctrine is very unique in this, in with regards to the afterlife.
It is.
Very unique with regards to the afterlife.
Well, so Jesus appears to Joseph Smith in the first vision, quotes Isaiah. They draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. I don't think Jesus is condemning every single preacher and saying, that guy's bad, that guy's bad, that guy's bad. I think he's saying, the doctrine is so lost that they can't draw near to me with their hearts because what they understand about me doesn't merit hearts. Like, I have to, like, reveal my nature again. And then I need to reveal it to each of them individually, because if you read Calvin and you'd been taught Calvin your whole life, then you might try to say the right things, but there's no way you're going to feel the right things because he's not worthy of those kinds of feelings.
I will say this, though. I don't really want to branch off into a religious discussion here. And
that's my bad.
You're fine. You're fine. But I do want to say this, because I grew up feeling like I interpret everything Calvinistically.
Right.
And it was
like, put Calvinism back on.
Yes. And it was supported. I mean, I found plenty of support in the messages from the church and in general conference. I mean, that whole thing, you know, your will is the only thing that's uniquely yours. Now sacrifice it. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I push on that slightly?
Yeah. Push on it. I'm all for that.
So if you're giving up your will to somebody who wants to push you down, then it's that self-denial.
Sure.
If you're giving up your will to somebody who you trust perfectly and who loves you, they're not going to take the will and, like, chop it up. They're going to give it back to you, and it's going to be better. Like, I think that's C.S. Lewis's point, is that.
I agree.
Yeah.
But that's not the message that I got.
Exactly.
And that was the problem for me. And so...
So, like, in a marriage, we give up a lot of our will.
Mm-hmm.
We say, this is somebody that I want to make a life with, and I trust you, and I want blank, but you want blank, and so I'm going to give that up, right? Like, and it's not – and if it's done – so my challenge, honestly, in my marriage is that when I have done that, a lot of times I do it half-heartedly and resentfully. And when I do it wholeheartedly and I say I can choose, like, I'm not going to blame my wife for this choice I'm going to make. I'm going to choose. Do I want to do this or not? Then I can let the soft animal of my body love what it loves. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm not pretending that I want what she wants. I'm wanting what I want and then
right.
dealing with that.
And I think that's the distinction, because when I got married, I thought I was no more.
Me too.
I thought, okay, Scott Edgar does not exist anymore. Now you're married, you've become one. And so your will, nothing matters. And that is false. And that's destructive.
Yes.
Because you lose yourself.
Yes.
And one thing that
you become someone not worth being married to.
Yes. And also,
because they don't want to be married to some AI.
Right. But even more than that, I agree with that. And I will add to that I became somebody I didn't want to be with.
Exactly.
Because I gave up myself. I felt dead inside for most of it.
Yeah.
I felt dead inside. And I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought that's what I should be doing.
Right.
But it was not helpful.
It was well-intentioned.
Some of it was out of fear.
Right. But it was like the only thing you knew.
Right. That's fair.
You didn't know how.
Yeah. I thought I was doing what I should be doing.
Exactly. Same.
Right.
And I think that I've learned, like, that's not best.
Mm-mm.
And it's a dead end.
No. That's
it, it won't get you there.
It won't get, and it was dishonest with myself.
Dishonest with,
because
yeah.
I look back and I think, yes, I thought I was doing it, but I always sensed that, like when I was taking that philosophy and literature class.
Right.
I felt myself.
There's a reason that specifically, oh, interesting. Meaning you had that
like this is me.
This is perfect.
This is me. This is who I am.
Yeah.
But no, I can't show up that way because I'm scared.
You didn't have the courage yet.
I didn't have the courage yet. So I pushed it away. And so I don't resent that.
Right.
But it's interesting for me to look back at that, because I remember thinking, oh, I feel alive.
Right.
I feel full. I feel like a person. Yes. I feel like somebody.
And I think that is such an important signal. Like, we can't let that signal drop. We've got to hold on to it. So let me, you were going to.
No, you go ahead. You got something.
So I don't think Mary Oliver is saying you don't have to self-flagellate, so therefore do whatever.
Right.
Because, I mean, she's just like, she's a naturalist. Like, as far as I can tell, like, most of her poetry she wrote while walking around. Just walking
feels
around
like
with boots on, like in like this muddy forest, you know, with her dog, and she loved her dog. And so, like, at the end it says, whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. So, like, whoever she's writing to has agency. Like, there's all these options. The world is offering itself. Your imagination matters. Calls to you. The world calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting. So she's not like, hey, this is all going to be fun and games. Sometimes harsh, but also exciting. Like, it's really rough to try and do something and do it poorly. And it's really rough to start a business and lose all your money. And it's really rough to have a relationship end. Over and over announcing, and this phrase I just love, your place in the family of things. Like, you have a place. You're not a goose.
Right.
You're not a tree. You are Scott, and I'm Josh, and I have a place. And it's not a place
in the world,
the natural world, in the family.
The family of things.
The family of things. So, like, you have, you're in the family to a certain extent with that goose. And sometimes I'm a little resistant to that, because I'm not the biggest naturalist. You're a much better naturalist than I am.
And to be clear, it's not because I run around naked.
is that a definition of naturalism?
That's what came to my mind. I don't know.
State of nature. But I was thinking, I don't know, maybe this is a bad example, but like in Downton Abbey, it's a story of a family in a place, in a house. And the house isn't a member of the family in the same way that one of the kids is a member of the family. But the house is still a little part of the family. You know, and so like the manor, like there, like that goose is in the family to a certain extent in some way.
We had a Chevy Suburban that died a year ago, and it had been on countless road trips with the family.
There you go.
And it was emotional getting rid of it. In fact, my youngest daughter, Ruby, had me cut out a couple swatches of carpet out of it. But it was part of the family. It was hard to let it go. Weird.
That's so cool.
But I do like that point. We all have a part to play. And so I want to, because I love that second half of her poem. She says here, so you only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And then she says, tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you about mine.
That's my favorite line.
Why is it your favorite line? And I'll talk about mine.
I'm going to read it like a lawyer for a second.
Okay.
She does a really cool grammatical thing in this line. Tell me about despair, comma, yours, comma, and I will tell you mine. So she only has three punctuation marks, two commas and one period. Yours is a parenthetical. I think what she might be trying to say is that none of our despair is very unique. Like, there's despair, and then a subset of despair is yours. Tell me about despair, yours. And I'll tell you about mine. She doesn't say, tell me about yours if you have despair. She knows you have despair. She assumes it.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't say, if I have some, I will tell you mine. I have despair. We all have despair. Like, tell me about despair and then subset yours. Tell me about, and I will tell you mine. And there's something really powerful about telling our despair. Not in a necessarily like nobody wants to hang out with this way.
No.
But just being open and being like, yeah, there's despair. There's joy, but there's despair. And there's, you know, we all have it.
Here's why I think it's powerful is because we do all have it.
Yeah.
And how many of us pretend like we don't?
Yeah. And it, I think she might be saying like, it's so fundamental to humanity that we deny our humanity when we pretend like we don't have any despair.
Well, so much of meaning, you know, we talked about this earlier before we started recording. So much of life's meaning is lost in pretending like we don't have despair and that we don't. We spend so much of our life trying to avoid suffering. You know, when I was younger, part of this fear that I had was, I wanted to avoid suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have future plans. I didn't have expectations.
Right.
I would wake up in the morning and I would just do whatever I could to avoid suffering. And if I had school assignments that were due, I would ignore them until the last minute.
Mm.
And that was so I'd have this intense microwave type suffering, you know,
instead of prolonged oven suffering
right.
at 350 degrees.
Exactly. and so I spent so much time avoiding suffering, but we have it. And so when you hear somebody talking about it, I mean, that's really the impetus or the reason I wanted to start this podcast was to talk about these things, because when you hear somebody else talking about their suffering and their despair and their struggles, I get emotional.
Yeah.
I get emotional.
You can feel when it's real.
Yes. Yes. Right. And
like even the person who's exaggerating it a little bit, you can feel.
Yeah, I mean, who's completely honest?
Right.
You know, who's? I mean, we want to be.
But there's something just like so powerful when somebody says something that's like as fully true as they can make it.
Yes.
It's just like it brings tears to my eyes, whether it's good, bad, like it's like the honesty of it is just like, oh.
Yes.
It's a delight.
And you feel a connection with that person.
Yes.
And connection is what it's all about.
Right.
It's
part of the family of things.
Right. Because you can even feel a connection to other animals when they're suffering.
Totally.
You can feel these connections and that's it.
To the suburban.
Yeah, to the suburban, to some inanimate object.
To a place.
To a place.
Yeah,
exactly.
To a house.
Yeah. I love that she talks about that though. Tell me about about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. And then the next line, I love this. Meanwhile, the world goes on. And here's why I love that. And I've just talking to a really dear friend of mine. She's going through a really tough time right now. And I mean, like a tough time that breaks people.
Yeah.
And as a result, it's always on her mind.
Yeah.
And it overwhelms everything.
Yeah.
And we were talking the other day about this. And we were talking about how you know, our lives, we have different parts of our lives, you know, this part of her life that's so overwhelming right now. It's such a big part that it like casts a shadow over all the other good stuff. Mm. But there are other areas in her life and in my life. I mean,
they're just harder to see right now.
Yes, but they are still going on and they're still good. Meanwhile, the world goes on.
Yeah.
Like we talked earlier, the sun sets. Yeah. You know, spring is coming regardless of the pain that you're feeling. Spring, the flowers are growing.
Yeah.
The, you know, in fact, I talked to you about this Rilke poem. This line in here, he says, well, let me just read the whole poem and then kind of touch on it. Because this poem kind of talks about, it's almost the opposite of what we just read from Mary Oliver. He says, Lord, the great cities are lost and rotting. Their time is running out. The people there live harsh and heavy, crowded together, weary of their own routines. I read that and I think these people aren't honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. They are, maybe they don't know how to be. Mm. Maybe they're just surviving and lost. That's the feel I get. He continues, beyond them waits and breathes your earth, but where they are, it cannot reach them. The world goes on. Hmm. The earth is out there, but they can't see it because they are caught up in their despair and they're not looking up. Hmm. They are in their routines. I think that's the word, routines. And then this is the line that Mary Oliver's poem made me think of. Their children waste their days on doorsteps, always in the same shadow. They don't know that somewhere wind is blowing through a field of flowers. Hmm. And I won't finish the poem, but the reason I love that so much is there's always wind blowing through a field of flowers somewhere. Hmm. And there's always beauty out there somewhere. But we let sometimes, well, I'll speak personally. There are times when my despair overwhelms me. Hmm. And I don't have the strength or the ability to reach out sometimes. And I forget that the beauty is out in the world.
Right.
And I don't have to earn that. It is, like we mentioned earlier, the sun is still, we have that beautiful sunset every night, the stars at night. We have sunrise. We have the, you know, where we live, we have the canyons. We have the creeks coming down, the sound of the running water. We have the beautiful flowers that are bursting out of the earth right now, the fruit trees that are blossoming,
the clear pebbles of the rain.
The clear pebbles of the rain. That is there, regardless of the despair we're feeling.
Yeah.
And the despair that we're feeling is only part of our life.
Yeah.
It's not our whole life.
Right.
It's only part. But it's sometimes sometimes it gets heavy, so heavy that it overwhelms everything else.
Yeah.
And that's the value of sharing your despair with somebody.
Yeah.
Tell me your despair. Let me listen to it.
Tell me about despair, yours. Yeah. I will tell you mine. I think it's three meanwhiles.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, we were talking about this a little bit before, but to me there's like this meanwhile double meaning. I don't know if irony is quite the right word, but like sometimes you can be in despair and you can be like, how are people driving their cars right now?
Yeah.
Don't they know? Don't
I felt
they know that.
That
this person died? Don't they know that this tragedy has happened? Don't they know how miserable I am? Like, how could it go on?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it can feel like, I don't know, like everybody's, like creation is laughing at the despair. But something that I'm learning too is there's a peace in knowing that me having a bad day isn't going to wreck everything else. Like, it's not my job to make the sun rise or set. And it's not my job to make spring come and to send the pebbles of rain. Like, I just got to, like, try to run my little body and my little house and my little family. And some days I can't, and that's okay. And some days I can, and that's okay. And like, meanwhile, like, no matter how bad it feels to me at that moment, meanwhile, it's just going to – life is going to go on. And I can't frustrate that.
And when the despair passes, and it usually does, it's going to be there for you.
It'll be there.
You don't have – I mean, it's not like it's going to die for your lack of attention.
Right.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Right. Meanwhile.
Meanwhile.
Your place in the family of things.
Yeah. Have you read much others of Mary's stuff, Mary Oliver's stuff?
Yeah, not a ton, but I just find this in all of it that I've read so far where it's, she's not trying to convince me she's a great poet.
Well, what I love, I mean, just stylistically, and you mentioned this to me as well, it's easy.
It's easy.
It's not Shelley. Yeah. You know, it's not like, wait, I got to go back and reread that line. What's the antecedent of that? I don't remember. You know, this is just...
The grammar is easy.
Well, it's easy and it's conversational.
Yeah. And there are references here, you know, deserts, repenting, mm-hmm. soft animal. But they're not like, you know, if you haven't read Homer, you're not going to understand
right.
this. Like, you know, right. it's, you know, she's... I could really imagine her like sitting down with us and reading that poem to us, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's just an easy, soft poem.
She's just a lady. She's just a lady.
Well, the poem almost, I mean, the structure and style of the poem almost, it supports the poem. Mm-hmm. It supports the meaning of the poem, mm-hmm. you know. It's like, hey.
She's modeling the poem yes. in the poem.
Yes. Yeah. Like, hey. It's okay. It's okay. Things are going to be okay. It's this is easy. Okay. It's like your grandma's got her arms around you. Yeah. Hey, sweetheart. It's yeah. okay. It's
that's
okay.
Right. She's like a grandma.
Yeah, it's okay. That's the feeling that
she's
I get
like,
from
hey,
that.
I've seen a lot of springs and a lot of winters. Like mm-hmm. it just keeps coming and going. Just don't be too stressed.
Yeah.
All the stuff that matters is in this little forest.
But what do you do when you can't see it? Mm. That's the question, because when I struggle, I usually know what I need to do to get out of it.
Hmm.
I do. I mean, it's not a mystery to me.
Interesting.
It's not a mystery. But there are times when I just don't want to get out of it.
Hmm.
And so when she, you know, you don't have to be good. I understand that. You don't have to walk on your knees. I mean, what do we do? I mean, I have certain things that I am learning to do now. But it can be scary sometimes when you know what to do, but you don't want to do it.
Yeah. Something that, like, going back to the first line that you do not have to be good. Sometimes I think in my mind I'll say, like, if you're not super productive today, like, what is the point of you? Like, what are you, like, right. you only called back 5 clients and didn't call back the last 2. Like, what is the point of you?
Mm-hmm.
You're not ready on your trial that's in 6 months. What, you know. And what I'm learning to do better is to say, to take inventory more often and be like, what do I have today? Like, what kind of energy do I have? And I have this fear that if I have low energy today, that'll last forever. And mm-hmm. it's just never happened so far. Maybe it'll happen. But just being okay and being at peace with, you know, this is the expertise I have today. This is the energy I have today. That's really all I can do. I'm being okay with it. And if it's bad, then meanwhile, the world goes on. Like, yeah. it's, you know, it feels really important to me right now, but all I can do is what I can do right now, and to just be a little bit at peace with that.
Excellent. Josh, it's been great.
Well, give us yours and then you can end.
Oh, you want to know mine?
Yeah.
Sorry. What I try to do is I try to pause. Mm. It's
that's the hardest part.
It is. And I used to forget to, and now things would go off the cliff. And so about a year and a half ago, I wrote this thing, and I think I've talked about it before, but I just call it start of the day. Mm. And then I read it and it just says it's the start of the day. And today things may come at you that are painful. Things may happen to you, including fear that may come at you from inside or outside of yourself. And then I have some things to remember. Remember to pause and breathe.
Mm.
Remember to be kind to yourself and gentle with yourself. Mm. Remember that there are people that love you.
Mm.
Remember to reach out to those people when you need. Remember that you can't control everything, but there are things that you can control. Remember that you need to work on the things that you can control and that you're able to.
Mm.
And remember that these painful things, including fear, will pass. Remember that you will be okay.
Mm.
So that's what I do.
Mm.
And I start out with pausing, because it used to be that I'd go off a cliff and then I just have to wait for it all to burn off. but so I wrote that. And so I try to read that in the mornings just as a reminder as I start my day that, okay, when it starts to get overwhelming, first step, pause and breathe.
I find that I need to find a new one that says basically that periodically. Like, one won't work forever.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? It'll kind of wear off.
Well, it does wear off in the sense that I think that I know it, and so I say I won't read it today because yeah. I remember it. But reading it every day, for me, like, intentionally reading it, sitting down, blocking everything out, having the paper in front of me, intentionally looking down and reading it and thinking about each
focusing.
Okay, pause and breathe. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Where, what are some instances today?
Feel that sentence.
Yeah. What are some instances today that, that I need, may need to implement that? Do I have anything coming on today that's may trigger that?
Well, this is mine right now, Wild Geese.
This is a fantastic poem.
That's my, it's my version of that.
It's good.
That self-reflection. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, I appreciate it. You called me and asked me about it, and I thought, let's get her, fire
let's
her up.
Do it.
So, all right, until episode 3 that we record, our third episode.
Oh, yeah.
Third episode, yes.
Until then.
All right, my brother. Thank you.
See ya.
All right, bye.